Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal force, the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, good elevenses, good tiffin, good whatever, whomever, animal, vegetable or mineral, whatever state of decomposition I find you in. Welcome to Agitators Anonymous. This is Alan Averill. And this is part two of a conversation with Josh Barnett. We left part one with something to do with having your head fucked up. Who knows what that was about? It was about politics. So if you want to go back and listen to the end of part one, this will inform you from whence we start. So this is part two. Go over to patreon.com/AlanAverill if you want to support the show, support me, whatever else. There's demos, there's unreleased this and that and the other and bonus podcasts and all sorts of stuff. www.hatecouture616.com for some evil apparel, t-shirts and all that kind of thing. Free shipping. Go and have a look. Use the promo code Alan. And if you're in North America, metalblade.com. If you use the promo code AAPodcast, you will get 10% off. So there you go. The two ad reads, etc., etc. Instagram is nemthianga_primordial. Join my bot army. We're making preparations. We're having war games, all sorts of things, preparing for the big day, the big drone strike day. Shouldn't have said that, but here we go. All right, Josh Barnett, part two. The whole conversation in its entirety will be up on my YouTube, so you can watch it from start to finish. But for technological reasons, the rendering process does not allow for such a long podcast. So here we are, part two. Josh Barnett, get in there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I also think that the failure of the institutions of the state and, you know, the broader, I suppose, in Europe, the broader European Union project to deal with the pandemic has made me sometimes closer to the arguments of people, let's say, on the far left sometimes, who have been, you know, raging at the same institutions that maybe I would have, I won't say defended in the past, but elements of it, now I am sided with them because this whole last year has been such a botched response by an obviously broken system, that I've found that the people who I would have been, not say diametrically opposed to, but at least standing foot looking at things from a slightly different angle, I kind of go, yeah, I see your anger at this system, because this is the same system that has spectacularly failed to deal with this situation.
Do you remember when our last conversation, I talked about the fact that that people, how they react from this feeling will differ, but generally everybody generally has a kind of thing in their gut telling them that things aren't actually, people, the systems aren't accountable. They're not actually doing the things that they said that they're going to do, that they're not, that it is a rule for thee, for me and not for thee. I mean, these things were obvious, but then from that, you know, based on their tribal orientation and their ideological bent, you know, they'll displace it into one thing or the other. I mean, it's like bringing up the governmental or even non-governmental organizations, these giant body politics that we're supposed to rely on for proper meaning towards certain instances, like let's say with pandemics would be the WHO. Well, you can go and look through the corruption of the WHO, the stuff that they will do on behalf of China, how they will, you know, won't accept Taiwan, how they got things wrong or outright lied early on, and they could just keep changing. But what happens is things like the WHO take a tribal side and they take an ideological side with that. And so then it just becomes, as we've become so much more tribal, not to say, and I'm not here to be against tribalism to a degree, I'm just saying that we've gotten so far with our heads up our ass that we, you know, we think our rectum is somehow the defenders of peace and you know, order. And it's like, nah, you're just smelling your own shit, bud. You know, but you can go look at this and they just throw it away, like, oh no, all my meaning making apparatus for all this has told me that it doesn't matter, and they've thrown it under the rug, and who cares? You know, when Vox says, oh, you know, don't be an idiot, it's just going to be the flu, it's just that, it's just this, blah, 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 you don't need to wear a mask. And then they delete all their tweets about it and everything. And it's like, they toe the line with the WHO. And then if, I don't know, if, you know, Fox was saying never wear a mask and you don't, you know, it's just the flu. And then they, you know, everybody just acts like they had no part in fucking this up. And yet also, there's no forgiveness for being wrong anymore.
Yeah, that's one of the very important thing. Yeah, is that
I wouldn't, if the WHO was legitimately just wrong about something. Let's just remove the guy who got installed there from Ethiopia by the Chinese government or any of that shit. Let's just say the WHO is an actual, mostly pure organization. All right, if you make a mistake, you make a mistake. Just say you made a mistake, but then we, on our hand, have to go, okay, who are you that you are so perfect that you could never get this wrong, especially with something new and unknown and you've never dealt with?
Sure.
You know what?
But they have been running. I agree with you. I think that these institutions have perfectly played us, the public, yes, to not forgive each other when we should actually have forgiveness in our social canon, our social language. But they've been, you know, they've gone through the pandemic, I guess the procedure over the last amount of years. They've run the numbers. They've, you know, already run their pandemic, I suppose what you call it, pilot pandemics over the last 10 years. That's not the right word, whatever, you know. But
they're models. They ran these models on things.
But when you're dealing with the lives of X amount of people, then they should, of course, try and get these things right. Of course, they don't. But it's a different sense in the forgiveness between people. I think what I was trying to say was, though, that my level of forgiveness for the people who I would have politically disagreed with in the 2 or 3 years ago now has been greater than ever. Oddly enough, this fucking brutal situation, this self-isolating situation, has given me a little bit more altruism with people's anger, even if I think it's still misplaced from the other side. I'm not sure what to do with that. because I all I can concentrate on is that society, you know, that I think that democracy has been paused, civil liberty has been suspended in favor of health and safety, or
whatever. Well, we don't have, I think if anything, this has just shown that we don't have democracy. We haven't had democracy. There's no democracy in the West. That doesn't exist. It's a fairy tale. It's a fable. Robert Michaels' Iron Law of Oligarchy is in full effect. And Burnham's interpretation of Pareto's elite theory is in full effect. It is absolutely obvious and above board. And if you understand these concepts, you will see it at plain as day. You know, there is no democracy. There is no democracy in the West, period. There's nothing democratic about it. There is no truly holding any systems accountable for anything that they do. There's always a way at which they can excuse it. And for some reason, we allow it to be excused. And maybe part of that is because we don't really have any power to change it. We can't vote our way out of any of this.
Well, I mean, I would say that prior to this, I think a form of democracy was evident across the West. Now, it depends on the levels, of course, of endemic corruption and all these other factors that contribute to that. But it's still in Ireland, for example. Ireland is one of the oldest social democracies in the world, mm-hmm. and that never had fascism and never had communism. And, you know, the people...
Yeah, I learned this on a podcast. I learned this on this podcast I listen to all the time.
Yeah. So there's like... and we have this thing called proportional representation, single transferable mm-hmm. vote, which only Malta, Canada, Cyprus or something use. But we do have... I mean, there is a democracy in place in Ireland, but... It moves and sways. Let's say Italy might, Italians might have it. There might be slightly more endemic corruption through history than other countries.
Well, let me ask you this much. If you were to run for the badass black metal party and you, Alan Averill, how do I say that last name?
You can say it as Averill.
Averill. What makes you think you'd ever be able to garner even hardly a single vote? I mean, because here's the thing: while the parties themselves, let's say, they couldn't exactly stop you. They couldn't say, "Well, you're not allowed to be voted for." But what they would do is they would run a massive campaign through all the media outlets, through everything else. They would try to go through. They would have somebody sit down with every album, with every lyric you've ever written.
Of course, yeah.
They would go through that. They would do everything they could to basically say that, well, if you vote for this guy, he is a weirdo, he's terrible, he's evil, and everybody who associates with him is evil.
Of course,
they'll try to find every picture of you standing next to somebody that once did a thing. And so they would effectively all rally behind their narrative of ensuring the power of the elite,
sure,
and the way that the institutions are already created to make sure that you were never, ever a viable candidate.
I do understand that, and I agree. But I also think that two points of view in this circumstance can be both true at the same time. Like at the moment, we have one independent TD standing up to almost the entire government opposing lockdown. One guy, and he makes the news every now and again. And he stands up and he goes, we need to talk about civil liberty and this, that, and the other. And the whole government goes, ugh. But he's still there. And he's still on the news and he's still got people galvanizing some form of public support. Now, me, of course, our baggage that we carry with us to this point where we might get into politics might make it difficult, or it might appeal to a certain demographic. But I agree with you; it's probably going to disavow or disavow.
Well, my whole thing is not necessarily even your particular Allen baggage. I just mean, sure, like, you know, not your forays into New York, okay. as I've listened to with much glee on this Agitators Anonymous podcast, which is, by the way, one of my absolute favorite listens.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Period. I think that you are not only an amazing musician and frontman and lyricist, but your knack for this. anyway, what am I saying?
Yeah.
So, it would not just specifically you. It's just that you are not a part of their circle. It's the George Carlin. That. It's a big world, and it's a big group, but you ain't in it. And so the fact that you ain't in it would mean they would not allow you to be a part of it.
I agree with you, but I think that I agree. But I also think, I also do believe that not everything is a 100% theory in this regard, and that there are people can appear from out of nowhere and break the system here and there.
We've seen it.
Yeah, of course.
But now look what we're dealing with.
Across Europe,
across
Europe, you can see there is fluctuating different parties and this and the other. It's just in this particular situation, which is this health emergency. Let's say if we consider some of the powers that be, whether it's malign or benign, remains to be seen-ish. But certainly when there is an emergency, they can pause. They can go pause on democracy. And like all the things that have happened to us, whether it's the lockdown, it's the vaccination process, all these kinds of things, none of them. Like in the UK, they've put 65 new legislations, none of which have been even put to the floor of Parliament or even discussed. Like we passed through something like 20 to 30 new laws for the police here about 2 months ago or something. And they gave opposition politicians an hour or less or half an hour to read the dossier, so to speak, or whatever it is. And no one opposed it because no one got to the hilt of the argument. And so all of these, they call it sunset clauses, which means there's no real end. Like there's no, like give these what are supposed to be temporary powers to the guards to enforce fines and regulations on people, but they don't, they're open-ended. So we've been like hurrying through. So I totally accept your point, but yet at the same time, I don't believe it's a total farce. I believe it's a majority of a farce, but not a total farce, if you know what I mean.
Okay, well, I'm a bit more pessimistic, I suppose, than you are.
I don't know about that, but I do think that there can be, for example, you can get a populist party who appears out of nowhere in a European country who can come, and in a very democratic state or principled state, that's complicated, which has, let's say, more which has more than two parties that isn't a first past the post system, such as Holland or Belgium, or even in Germany. Like in 10 years ago, there was no AfD. Now there is an AfD, just as a bad example, which will get me into trouble. But you can find
out. By the way, talking about a group is not necessarily an endorsement of a group. Like me saying Obamacare had issues doesn't mean that somehow
I know that
whatever Trump care would mean somehow like that.
So, I mean, all I'm just saying is that there are parties who come from nowhere in obscurity and they rise up on a wave of a form of populism, and they can affect politics. But I do understand.
Well, I mean, for good or bad, do they have any real effect?
Well,
how many of them even exist anymore? So, I mean, you know, if you look at Trump and his whole thing, I mean, that would be probably the one of the biggest examples of just a populist outsider interest, you know. And this is not whether or not you think he was good or bad or on a personal or even political level. It's just it is obvious that he is a outsider getting into the political sphere of the elite. One, it was not appreciated, and this was not on either side. Don't fall into that bullshit idea that somehow Republicans were all they weren't really. They were just down for what it did for them.
Yeah,
Republicans are basically just Democrats going a little slower speed. So there isn't really much difference, and I also say that because some of the policies that have been the most detrimental to U.S. politics over and governance over time were not instituted by one party. They were backed by both and or instituted by one and followed through by the other and continued by each other. And so no one party can be like, yeah, well, you know, that one was the worst because no, you guys all got in on it together. You both are kind of seeing things moving in the same direction and you're okay with that. It's just you have little nitpicks about how fast it should go and who should get to be in charge about it. But so he was managed to get in there as a purely populist outside element, and the absolute state of things went insane. And, you know, trying to sitting back ever and just having just a purely rationalist conversation about the nature of things and having to say, no, that's not what he said, or no. I mean,
of course.
I'm like, Jesus Christ, don't make me defend, you know, this blowhard, because you're so only because I want you to speak from what is actually happening, just so that we can have a better viewpoint on how to view what's going on from not just the short term to the long term. But it was just mind boggling to me. And it got to be such a, I'm like, this sucks. And they're like, oh, well, are you making, you have a contradictory statement. Like, oh, well, that must mean you're pro Trump. I'm like, I'm not pro any of these people. I'm not pro them. I'm sorry. I'm trying to at least have the most objective place I could view what's going on from. And then following all this insanity, the one thing that really stuck out to me with the pandemic stuff was the expansion of censure across everything. It wasn't just that, no, we made a mistake or whatever. It was that if they made a mistake, it was like, no, it never happened. We're going to erase it. And then we're going to censure everything about it. We're going to make sure that you can never speak of it. We will try to deperson you in every way. And we will essentially try to smear you at the same time so that no one will want to touch you for potentially contracting the same, public virus that you have.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the most problematic things with all of this, is that one of the structures with which we built our modern civilization on was the idea of due process, the idea of being able to, be accused of something and defend yourself. Yeah. But my YouTube channel could, let's say in theory, it's just removed. I don't know anybody at YouTube. You can't talk to anybody.
You're right. And so, you're not a big enough fish for YouTube to talk to you, because they will talk to you if you have enough, if there's enough skin in the game to help you, because it's giving money to them. Here's the other thing. Yeah. Let's say YouTube says, Mr. Averill, I hate your Aleister Crowley intro and blah, blah, blah. And you're banned forever because that guy was, he's no good, Nick. All right. Well, all right, I'll just I'll upload onto Gab or I'll upload onto BitChute or something. It's like, now you're a far right Nazi because you're on that platform. It's like, whoa, I haven't said anything different. I'm not proclaiming any Nazi ideas or anything, of that sort. But just because you use something that isn't YouTube, let's say, if it's not YouTube or Daily Motion, I imagine, if it's any sort of alternative platform, it's like, you're an evil person. Yeah. If you had a Parler account, well, it's because you're a racist and all this stuff. And it's like, whoa, how does that work? I mean, I imagine if you log in on Stormfront, perhaps, there's probably, you're into talking about racist stuff. But I'll be perfectly honest, back in the day, I remember Google searching my name or using that Google platform. There's a Google bot that will send up things when your name comes up. And my name came up in threads on Stormfront. So I'm like, okay. And I'm reading these things. And it was highly entertaining, because it was to see these people come on board and be like, yeah, look at this Aryan looking mofo. And then for someone to chime in at the right moment and go, his girlfriend's black. At the time, and then watch them just dismantle. And I personally thought it was hilarious. It's like, you racist fucks. if you want to buy the fights because I'm on them, fine, put your money wherever it was. But I'm not. But it's just hilarious that through your own little ideological viewpoint here, you end up shitting on yourself, and it's great.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that I argue with people all the time. And they say that, like, I do think, they say to me, hey, look, these are private companies, they can do whatever they want. And you go, well, I just say to them, okay, well, what city do you live in? What if I was starting a company and it was called Alan Averill Parks and Company, Parks and Recreation, Alan Averill Parks and Recreation, and I bought every public park in your city and you weren't allowed in it? You'd be like, well, what the fuck? It's a public park. That's where we go to meet. Where we go to, I don't know, traditionally put on a stand on a little plinth and lecture, like at Hyde Park Corner in London. And
what was it called? The public square, right?
Yeah, Hyde Park Corner. Or you just go, no, I just went, hey, I own this. And you could say, oh, well, now it's a pub, it's a privately owned company, but it's a public space. The idea that they can't be considered public utilities, I think is wrong, because what I find fascinating is the same people who 10 or 15 years ago would have said, oh, well, look, Robert Maxwell owns all of these companies. It's a kind of like media oligarchy of the, you know, mm-hmm. are now not worried when all of the tech companies are owned by the same four or five people. And they,
well, they're tribal again. That tribalism, that gang yeah. mentality. Like
it will come yeah. for them. It will come for them eventually. But the idea that you can shut down the public square of debate to a certain section of people, and they won't return with pitchforks when they can't feed their kids because you've excluded them from society, to me is insane. It's like, you know, someone could just unperson someone, and then they don't have an income, a revenue stream, or whatever, blah blah. What are they going to do? Desperate people in desperate times, what are they going to do? They're going to return to that public square, I think, pitchforks and go, right, let's have it.
And that, yeah, of course. And the more you isolate these people, the more they go to yeah. Stormfront or wherever else, and they get in that echo chamber, and they never, you know, they're like, yeah, I'm here because they're shutting me up because I must be correct, or I must yeah. be hitting a nerve or something. And, you know, they don't ever.
Yeah, or the other side or whatever. You're pushing people again to the sides. And if you take away their ability to feed their kids, mm-hmm. i.e., because let's think about it, like I think about this a lot last week or two, is that if everybody's been corralled into remote living, working online, and therefore that purely depends on, let's say, six different platforms. And if you say something that is deemed, wrong think, and they can pull your
PayPal. Heretical. I prefer the term heretical.
Heretical, okay. They can pull your PayPal, pull your whatever. And then you could just be here with no way to pay your rent, no way to feed your kids, no way to whatever. And you might go, you know what? Fuck it. I'll take that fucking pitchfork and I'll head to the square. And the next time there's a gathering of these people, I'm going to fucking.
Well, think about this. Let's go. Not only are you putting together this you're putting together this scenario where somebody is being deplatformed. Yeah, but also think of the fact that modernity is also corralling us into this mode of work and being where we have to use these things, where these yeah. are our outlets into the world now, especially, you know, mind even the pandemic, remove the pandemic overlay and just simply think about how many people have migrated themselves into a more social media, internet driven aspect yeah. of how they work and interact with other people. And now, if you take away the major aspects of those platforms, and so now, or their ability to make money through yep. these digital services for taking orders and what have you, what are they left with? Like, you really have put this person on an island, and yep. of course they're going to look for some island that suits them, that's going to allow them to hitch their boat up to it.
Well, look, what do desperate men do? I mean, you've got nothing more to fear than the aspirations of desperate men, as they say. Like, I remember, like, if you go to Eastern Europe, sometimes in my travels over the years, and you go to a failed state.
Like, oh, and Igor would tell you about this too, right?
Yeah, Igor, exactly. That's a very good example. Yeah, nobody would know that reference, but you and me. But I remember going to, like, you go to Moldova or something. I remember being in Moldova years and years ago. And it was after they had like a part of the military and the government stole like 10% or 20% of the GDP. They just stole it, disappeared, and fucked off. And Moldova is super poor.
Super poor. It's the poorest one in all of the EU.
It's a crazy little country. Not without its beauty, but it's crazy.
Great wine.
And lots of, I'll tell you a funny story about that in a minute, but lots of Moldovans came here. Their blue passport got them into Ireland. But the fact was that, that they were, there was no sort of economic hope of upward mobility for people in that country, you know? Mm-hmm. And the idea that, these were the sort of former satellite failed states, which had absolutely no mobility, sort of rendered people, I'm not sure what's the right expression. I'll have to edit this out.
Are you thinking about like a like a sense of hope or will or, you know, some sort of internal motivating aspect or.
Well,
there's no promise of, I guess I'm getting lost now on this.
Well, what about, I think what I was trying to say is that when you go to these countries and you see that there is no hope of, you know what, I can't remember what I was talking about.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess anywhere where, so that's a thing. If you don't feel like there is an opportunity to be able to construct the life in a way that's fulfilling to you, I would say. So if you can't, if you feel like you don't have the ways to create what is meaningful, you're going to start to harness, let's say, an aspect of sickness, right? A kind of a cancer. I think that's probably one of the biggest problems of modernity is that it has replaced a lot of the things. Well, it's too materialistic. It thinks that, you know, science and rationality and reason can do everything. And it's like, well, clearly it can't, you know, but how do we create a marriage between what seems to be an unchanging element of human behavior and yet trying to use our rational and reasoning brain to work within that without just constantly going from one overarching myth to the other. And you know, it's tough. I think one, you'd have to read a lot of religion and you'd have to read a lot of history to try and figure that out. Even says me, the atheist, but
I have a funny story about Moldova. That's a complete sidestep to what we're talking about, because I was thinking about something and I had my train of thought completely went there, but I had this really funny experience in Moldova, which I'll detour this conversation just for like 3 minutes, if you'll indulge me.
All right. I'm all ears. Look, okay. I'm all ears. I lay it on me.
Right. So I was in Romania. So it's
beautiful place. I've had a lot of fun in Romania. Yeah.
It's a long, silly story, but I'll start with it. So we're playing in Romania. I was playing in Romania 2 weekends in a row, one with Dread Sovereign, one with Primordial. And I decided to stay on and go to Moldova and then Odessa on the Black Sea in Ukraine, mm-hmm. And take the old crippled train round from Bucharest all the way up to Moldova. Now, the story begins with me buying some kind of drugs or other in Romania with Red Sovereign and having...
I hope you have Palinka with you too.
Well, and going to Moldova to Chișinău and... let me go back a minute. Chișinău in Moldova has the second biggest wine cellar in the world. There's one in France, which is bigger. And it's on the outskirts of Chișinău, which is it's like a super impoverished city. I don't know if people know like quite how third world or second world it is. Like you can get in your car theoretically and drive from Moldova to Berlin if you really want to. I think that, you know, once the borders come down, but this is like a satellite Soviet country. Mm-hmm. That was that's in the northeast of Romania between
the to mention has a high Russian population over the length of being in the Soviet Union because they pushed Russians into Moldova on purpose to try and make sure that it never would try to separate itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they would have greater control over the government.
Yeah, I mean they have there's a ghost state called Transnistria, which I went through as well to get to Ukraine. Like a self-declared sort of communist military state, which you have to declare yourself. I went to a wine cellar in Kirkovia, which is in Moldova, just on the outskirts of the capital, Chișinău, whatever you want to say. And like you get this taxi out through the darkness out into this poorly lit suburb, and this huge like Taj Mahal sort of bizarre structure of this this wine cellar, very famous wine cellar, and it's about 30 euro to get in. And if you've ever been in Moldova, that's about the equivalent in Ireland of about 300 euro, 250 euro entry. So me and my friend were the only people to go in. We descended minutes, and then it's just endless corridors of just wine cellars and just wine everywhere. And it's really, really strange. And I remember like one person showing us around, and she's like, this girl was like, and here you see Angela Merkel's wine. Here you see Hermann Göring's wine. And I was like, what the fuck?
Wow, okay.
Just like there. Yeah, you can see it on my Facebook pictures of it. And it's like a pile of wine covered in dust. And she is like, red wine does not depreciate. White wine does. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's just like, and she goes through all of these Nazis and leaders and people. And there's just this huge corridor of wine. And she's like, and here is Manuel Barroso's. And here is this. What the fuck? And like, literally, you're a foot away. You could break and smash everything.
Wow. So basically, all your favorite 70s dictators all have wine there still?
Yeah. The 1930s dictators. Yeah. And so they're all these wine is everywhere. And I said to her, like, because we descended long way. And she was being quite candid, and there was nobody else. Obviously, had come there all week. And I said to her, like, this is a nuclear bunker, right? And she's like, in every mockery, there is moment of truth. And I was there like, okay. And I said,
Eastern European too. I love it.
So I was shown into this, we're shown into this big like dining hall, a big dining hall. And just outside the door was all these pictures everywhere, like just like photographs on the wall of like Putin, Merkel, Manuel Barroso, all of these EU leaders and sort of IMF leaders, just like shaking hands, drinking wine. And we're sitting there and she goes, Putin celebrates his 50th birthday here. I was like, are you fucking joking? And she's like, no, they came here to celebrate 50th birthday. And then you go, then I was sitting there going, okay, Moldova is so centrally positioned in Europe with almost no press, no borders, no whatever. And you're sitting there thinking to yourself, wow, this is where they decided the fate of Crimea or the fate of Gorno-Karabakh or whatever it's called. And you're thinking to yourself, this is where people gather to decide those things. And of course, my imagination was like, just going over.
Where's the statue of Moloch or whatever, right?
But outside were just normal photos. There's all of these people. Like,
who owns Hermann Göring's wine? How weird is that?
I will post the photo to come up at the top. But Hermann Göring's wine. So basically what happened is that the Russians came across across to Berlin, and they obviously took a lot of things as they came across through Germany, and they sent them back into the Soviet Union. And they also just took, wine cellars, all this kind of stuff. So you can see this, like, I'm not joking. Like, she was talking, she goes, here is Angela Merkel's wine, like 100 bottles of red wine from 100 years ago. And she just goes, and here is Hermann Göring's red wine. And it was like 24 bottles. And I said, how much is each bottle worth? And she's like, we don't know, maybe 40,000 euro. And so I was there like, so that's like 300-400, half a million euro of wine just within.
It's definitely not the wine we were drinking last time. No.
But it's within like smashing distance. The amount of like, I was there, literally I could have just broken so much stuff. Of course, I have this thing of when I see lots of the same thing, I want to smash it. That's a completely different.
Oh boy, you must be fun in like candy stores and things like that.
But that's basically where we were, in this red wine candy store full of tyrants and despots' wine.
And I mean, the world is full of fucking reality is strange enough.
Red wine doesn't depreciate. So.
Oh yeah. Well, but you have to, unlike say whiskey. You really need to make sure that the temperature and the environment is just so, and even still old red wines can get to the point that they get, even in the right environment, they get crud that'll develop on the bottom of them and stuff like that. And I mean, I've had some old wines that were pretty fantastic, but I would much prefer a whiskey. I'm just a whiskey guy. I love what do they call it? The water of life in Scotland.
I'll tell you something funny is that my grandfather was an RAF pilot. And this is like sort of completely like non-podcast nonsense, but it's funny stuff is like, he came over to Ireland in the early 1950s. He was an RAF pilot. And the early Irish airline, Aer Lingus, had no pilots. So they couldn't train anybody. So they brought over, I think, 6 to 8 RAF pilots who'd flown in the Second World War and sort of housed them in Ireland, gave them jobs and all that kind of thing. But my grandfather was doing the first transatlantic flights from Ireland to the USA. And back in those days, you could bring anything back through customs, like literally anything. So back, my grandmother, she's almost 100 and still alive. There is about 6, 7, 8 presses of booze from like 1950 to 1985. Wow. Some of it, which hasn't even been opened. Whiskies from like 1960, gins from 40, 50 years ago. And we were looking them up, online. Some of them, you're like, oh, this apparently is worth €3,200 and all this kind of stuff.
You know? Yeah, well, I mean, I have some decently expensive stuff, but nothing of that nature. I don't know that I could spend that kind of money on booze, especially when I know I can get stuff that's $40 that's amazing right now. Like some Glendronach 12. Sherried Scotch is fantastic. A lot of the like Redbreast and Teeling offerings, if we're going to keep it Irish. We're talking about the Irish whiskey. Yeah.
That's it. Teeling Distillery is not too far from here, actually, but it's quite nice.
I visited last time and I got the distillery exclusive, which was a Teeling, I think it was a malt whiskey that they finished in a sherry cask and you got to pour it yourself at cask strength, and it's brilliant. It was, and I went on quite the escapade to drink as much Irish whiskey as possible when I was there to try all the different brands. But because of there's like a general consensus on Irish whiskey that to the point that most of it just tastes like every other one. You know, it's hard to find an Irish that really stands out and above and with a different flavor profile. Yeah, because of the tendency to distill it, to triple distill it, and then to bottle it at 80 proof, at 40%. It kind of gives you the same run-of-the-mill kind of look. Plus, a lot of Irish whiskey is made all in one of two distilleries, and so you get a lot of the same stuff. But the old Teeling stocks and the new stuff they're doing is fantastic. They're doing different cask finishes, which is really interesting. And Temple Bars, a label made whiskey out there. The Temple Bar 15 was absolutely brilliant. And I'm kind of kicking myself for not buying a bottle of that too, but maybe I was too pissed at that point.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm a bit of a vulgarian when it comes to whiskey, in the sense that whiskey to me isn't like, very often I've been visiting my friends in Sweden or Finland, they'll have pulled down something from the top shelf and gone, oh, you know, you need, you know, the Laphroaig, we'll have a drink of Laphroaig. And I'll go, listen, I'll tell you what, don't waste something nice on me. In a sense, I don't want whiskey that smells of smoke and tastes of earth. Whiskey means wasp on the stereo, cocaine, and fucking cheap bourbon. That's what whiskey means to me. Let's go. So I think I'm a vulgarian in this respect. I don't really appreciate these things.
Well, I could work to try and increase maybe your appreciation for whiskey, but at the same time, I'm also not going to stop 4 a.m. apartment visits and with Wasp on the radio. I'm good with that. You know, that's a fun time in and of itself.
But tell me, what podcast could possibly go from Obamacare to Moldovan wine cellars in the space?
Pretty much none. And you know, I guess, on a broader sense, not that everybody needs to be this way, but that I think it's kind of an important point in that to allow yourself to be a well-rounded individual of some sorts. I mean, obviously there's plenty of areas that both you and I have overlapped. There's areas in which we have a more specific personal understanding that the other doesn't. And then you could take the two of us and write tomes of all the shit that we didn't know. But yet it's okay, because as we continue to work through whatever it is we're doing on this journey of ours, it's being open to not only listening to the ideas that you don't like and finding, you know, some sort of empathy for those who suffer that are technically or could consider on your opposing way of thought, but also being open to whatever the world is willing to show you and what other people are willing to bring to the world themselves, to put out there and to be able to partake in it and to realize that, as I think it's pretty obvious, that most people have more things in common than they have different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe that's what's so maddening.
That is what absolutely maddening. I mean, the fact that, and this constantly comes up in my discussions with people, is the idea that no one is allowed to be nuanced anymore. There is no nuance. No. You're not allowed to hold two, like, explain to people, like, I say, from my point of view, you go, well, hey, look, I voted for gay marriage on one hand, but I hold maybe a conservative opinion about something else on the other, because people are, well, they're nuanced, and you're allowed to step on both sides of the spectrum and not really think about it too much. And the fact that we've lost our ability to recognize that you can hold two seemingly opposing points of view, which aren't really opposing. They're just made out to be now, because everybody
or they're it. Just slightly different interpretations, right? It's like 90% the same, but maybe it deviates 10% one way or the other. I would say that this is modernity. This is what Nietzsche's Death of God, this is modernity. This is the things that he talked about in his writings, that and I would say you could extrapolate it to the lack of meaning-making things means that something else has to become your meaning-making apparatus. And so, you know, as you get stripped away from any kind of foundational mythos that is helping to guide you in the world, you, of course, the aspects of ressentiment become far more apparent, especially now you've got social media and these fake looks into these manicured looks into the way the world is displayed to you. I'll bring up one of your favorite terms, the algorithm. And you know, I think about when you talk about the algorithm, and you know, I personally feel like I'm not at mercy to my algorithm, because I constantly doubt, check, and fight with my algorithm. I don't allow my algorithm to tell me anything. I always look at it as if, no, there's no way to trust you ever. And so my algorithm is something that I try to cultivate, so that I don't allow the things to just be shoved to me. I make a very deliberate choice to choose what I want to listen to, and choose where I will go, and choose what I want to be a part of, because I realize that with this ressentiment, this algorithmic aspect will absolutely do nothing but exacerbate it and try to put you in a whatever that algorithm starts to become, to put you into a cycle that you need to draw from it more and more and more, and that will tell you at which way that you need to position yourself in the world. And so you have all these things, you're stripping away all this meaning, and you get these people really, if it hasn't been, you know, religion of some sort for people for so long, then it'll be something else. And so now I think with social media allowing the greater connectivity, the aspect of algorithms, the way to insert propaganda so much more effectively and even innocuously into everything you do, and that now your meaning-making apparatus, your new religion, becomes your ideological position. It also becomes your tribe, based on your ideological position, your political orientation. And so therefore you will take some potentially even immutable characteristics of yourself, and now use that as your guiding compass into what it is that you are in the world, but not really realizing that isn't sufficient, actually. And it's not going to provide you with all the things that are necessary to be a healthy, well-rounded, you know, a person that can understand who they are,
yeah,
at their core, and how that will interact with the rest of the world around them.
I understand that, but I'm not sure that, I mean, without being condescending to, let's say, the general populace, I'm not sure that they have the time and space to consider.
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying that, you know, at the very start, you know, become more introspective,
yeah,
and disconnect from technology and modernity.
Yeah,
no, in a way, disconnect from the technology, get more interaction with the people in your life, but don't take everything to heart all the time. you know, allow people to say a thing. And if it contrasts your views, be okay with it.
Yeah.
You know, at the very least, especially if it's your friend, realize that they don't do it to cause you harm. Realize that they're in their own paradigm and that you're all under a paradigm in and of itself. And so it's until you figure out how to get outside of that paradigm, it's going to be difficult, and that's okay. And you can't know everything, and be okay with being wrong.
Ah, yeah.
That's a good start.
Yeah, that's a huge start. Just give me one second, actually. Hang on.
I had to fuck with it myself. Yeah. But yeah, no, I look, man, I get that it's not easy. Not everybody's even probably has the sort of a way of thinking and personality to want to do that. But, you know, there's something about the myths of all peoples throughout the world over time that have been used to anchor them into something. You know, sometimes it's a place, sometimes it's a, you know, it's a religion, or it could be a story, like a, you know, part of, you know, one of the fundamental, it seemingly things about the Jewish religion seems to be some, you know, the aspects of the diaspora, and also the, you know, the travel from here to there. And so, you know, it can be parts of these things. It could be a lot of different stuff. You know, I mean, human beings are capable of doing a lot of things in the world. But they're, you know, we're no different than anybody who wrote the Torah. We're no different than anybody who wrote anything older than that. Like, I don't believe that human beings have, you know, if I can read the Hagakure and I can read Nietzsche and I can read, or, you know, even going to the modern age, you can read Viktor Frankl or Maslow or someone, right? You're not coming across new responses from humans. You're not coming across new ways of thinking. You're not coming across new emotional construct. No, it's all the same. It is all the same. And to be honest, it probably always will be the same. I don't think we're going to evolve out of acting or having the feelings that we do, or being, you know, I'm very much of the sort that says that people love often these days to say that, we can just construct society to be a thing, or, you know, this is a socially constructed way of, you know, you think of this because society says so. And my argument would be, society even gets to the point of saying so because of biology, because of who we are, because of what we stem from, that we're not going to approach the, if you look at religion, you look at cultures, you look at all these things across time and history, more things are alike than they're different. You know, you can go the Joseph Campbell route, or you can do it in a different way. But the reality is that people's motivations across stories, across religious tomes, across music, it's the same aspects of mankind and their emotions and their conflicts and their overcoming and their deficits. And it's the same. And we react the same, but technology exacerbates it. It magnifies it. It increases the rate at which it occurs and or can affect others, right? You know, if you're in the Byzantine Empire, you're not affecting China that much, right? And if you are, you ain't doing it quickly. You're not doing it through a tweet. You know, someone's going to have to get up and get their ass over there. Or if you want to decide to have a Varangian guard, that ain't going to happen. You can't send a DM to some Norwegian Viking or Swedish Viking somewhere and be like, hey, you know, instead of going over to Russia or going here, how about you come down this direction? And, you know, we'll feed you well and all kinds of, you know, hot chicks and what have you. It's like, no, they just show up there and like, oh, fuck, what is this? I guess I'll call it the city of the middle of the world.
But that's, I think that... That's what, in a way, that speaks to a little bit of the circumstance of what's happening now, in the sense that within 1 year, to shut down the entire world and to separate people from their forms of humanism is such a drastic move in relation to exactly the things you're talking about, which are our human inheritance. And so I do really find that in my darkest moments in relation to where we are now, in relation to this, that it feels like there's an attempt to completely turn. Now, maybe it's just my exacerbation of the situation through my own pessimism and negativity and whatever. But there definitely seems to be an attempt to turn values that have existed for thousands of years on their head, which is,
yes,
you know, put people in their bubbles, alienate them, make them remote, you know, isolate them. And these go against all of our human instincts. And that's the one thing that gives me sort of, I suppose, an element of, I don't say hope, but maybe hope is the right word, that human, our will and want to be humans with each other can force this situation apart, or, you know, can end.
Well, you know,
interminable.
It's true. And if you even just, you know, to use just like a proxy concept, you know, a man once said, every empire will fall, every monument will crumble.
Yeah.
But, you know, what am I talking about? What am I talking about? I do think you're hitting something on the head. We think that we can reconstruct the world based on something, some theory we come up in a classroom, and it's like, no, it doesn't really work that way. And technology can't replace things that are essential to human flourishing.
Well, I hope not.
Can't.
I hope not.
No,
because,
yeah,
and that's what makes me consider many of the things that I consider about. And when you're reading about whether it's the Great Reset or all these kind of things, or,
yeah,
the echoes of the things that you hear from politicians,
right,
and the sort of technocratic institutions, and you're thinking to yourself, wow, is this really an attempt to turn society and humanity and their way of relating to each other on its head in 1 year? And I think, surely not. And then I look outside in my city and I go, wow, the city has been literally gutted of its spirit, its character, its personality in 1 year. And then you think, could they really? I think what's happening is maybe the greatest overreach in history that will have repercussions. But a part of me also looks outside and goes, wow, well played. If you wanted to subvert and demoralize people to such a point where they're so scared to not leave their houses.
Yeah, you gotta admire a well done plan, you know what I mean? And it's like,
by design or by accident, it's happening.
Yeah, I don't think Klaus Schwab, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know this guy, I'll never know this guy. I don't think he's likely to be an actual evil person. I don't think that he has any intent to do harm to the world. I don't think so. I think that people that write stuff like the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and, you know, that you will have nothing and be happy and all things will be delivered by drones and blah, blah. I mean, I think that they feel like they think that they're trying to do something for the right reasons. I really do. But that, you know, road to hell and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure there's a Primordial song about that somewhere.
No,
so,
doubt.
But nonetheless, you know, I personally just got to go, no, man, that's, I'm not, I don't want to transhuman. You know, everyone keeps going on about AI. How what it's going to do and how it should be used. And my thing is like, fucking, how about don't put AI or allow, even, you know, if it had to come to the point, like, no, AI cannot be the thing that, you know, runs all your interactions in public monetary exchange, or like, just how about you just don't fucking do it. If there's all these arguments that there could be a problem, it can replace all these, you know, the need for people to work and this, like, well, how about people need to do things? And so until you have a better understanding of what AI could do to be benign to our human flourishing and yet also a source of good, then fucking how about don't? How about you just don't?
I don't think that's possible, though, because I mean, if you think, I think about it a bit like this, is that even if you look at Charles Darwin was aboard a military vessel,
mm-hmm,
in that our exploration and our attempt to move technology along has always been linked to our military aspirations or all of these things. And so the idea that America wouldn't do this because China would, etc., still underpins our movement. But I totally agree with you in the sense that, I mean, having traveled extensively in Eastern Europe or whatever, there comes no good of angry young men with nothing to do on the street corners,
no,
that will only learn end up in ferment of revolution. And that's what you know, you want to say to this, okay, however much we think it's benign or malign, the Davos set, and you want to go, really, you want to make 40 million young men unemployed across the European Union zone? That I just took that number out of my
head. Yeah, and you think that you can deliver something that will therefore also give them a meaningful way of approaching life? Like, are you huge. That's borderline arrogant.
It's beyond, I think it's beyond even that. It's that you can, okay, so earlier this year, let's say last September, I managed to escape for a little bit. I went to Naples and I went to visit Keith from Destroyer 666 in down near Milan, and, you know, on his mountain where he lives, you know, and yeah, he lives on the side of a mountain. It's amazing. But anyway, I visited.
Speaking of Destroyer 666, new Nocturnal Graves from Jaro is out. Oh, kicks ass.
Okay. Jaro, what a good guy. Yeah. He played the drums on Phoenix Rising and stuff. Yeah, we played in Australia. We played with Nocturnal Graves and Ian. I used to live in a house with Destroyer 666 in Holland.
Well, that must have been it. That must be full of all kinds of stories.
I used to live in a house for about seven months in Holland in 2003 or four. I used to live on the floor of Ian from Nocturnal Graves and Destroyer, his bedroom. Yeah. There you go. Anyway, that's a story. That's a story for
another. Then you know what? There's no way you could get COVID at this point.
No, that's a story for another day, I think. But but the idea that this tiny set of people can somehow go, okay, this is how it's going to be for the next 5-10 years. And we're going to, how do you give tens of millions of people purpose? What I was saying is I went to Naples, right? You go to Naples and you go to this ancient historic city. You're going walking down these tiny streets and you realize there's tiny family businesses. There is historical, socio-cultural lineage of that city goes back thousands.
Right. It's not just monetary transactions. Yeah. It's not commerce.
It's a huge society that's interlinked for thousands of years. And what the reset is considering is, hey, can you just uproot all of that and dump it over here? And now none of that matters. It's like saying to Irish society, hey, by the way, the last 2,000 years doesn't really matter anymore. Your culture, your civilization, this is in its most extreme analysis. It's basically saying all of the things you knew that defined your city, state, culture, folklore, music, whatever you want, don't mean anything anymore. So moving ahead, can you just park your entire history of your culture? And so now let's move ahead, stay inside, do what you're told, etc. And you think to yourself,
right,
okay, I'm being very simplistic and, you know, jingoistic about my interpretation of that, and a bit fast and loose with that, but in a way you're going, wow, really, you want 457 million people in the eurozone to go, okay, we'll just stay inside and do nothing?
It's not even necessarily all that. It's not that, I mean,
but isn't
it's not that jingoistic? It's not that jingoistic in that.
No, but it's truly civil war, like, really, isn't it?
Well, of course. And truly, you think you're asking a question. It's like, well, you're saying that your program could deliver all the things that people need. That is such a deep statement right there. I mean, to be honest, I mean, people have, you know, you can go find any mainstream source to have a piece on the problem with the colonization and the drawing of borders within the continent of Africa. Okay, now you're going to say that
longitude and latitude. Yeah,
if that's a problem, if some giant overarching world government is going to now extract everything of material out of this place and somehow provide for every single completely different and spread apart tribe all across Africa. And now that, I mean, it's the same idea. Like, you can't just, it involves uprooting everything about who a people are and that's what they do and where they've come from, you know?
That's interesting. So what you're saying is, I haven't thought about it like that, in the sense that the aspirations of, let's call them the Davos set, are in the sense almost colonial, in a sense that it doesn't give any thought to the local tribalisms when you're just dividing up.
Correct, because to them, I'm sure even to them, having any tribal belief in, let's say, Anansi or any other classic African deities oh, that's just garbage and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, we can treat that as irrelevant, and yet it's not irrelevant to that person. It's not irrelevant to the Asagai, you know, the people that use the Asagai spears for hunting and have a whole tradition. I mean, you know, well, you could, oh, that's just a thing. You, why use spears anymore when you've got, but you know what? It isn't just about the thing. Yeah. There's so much, you know, that spear, who knows? Maybe it came down from a great relative. Maybe that spear to that person is, it's like, it's the spear is not just the object anymore to a person who has a livelihood that incorporates this item. And it's, it doesn't have to be a spear. It could be all kinds of things, you know? And they're deeper and more important, and they carry with them something that even if I didn't relate or entirely understand, it didn't derive from, it's not something of my life's journey, but to that person's life journey, this is everything. And to take that away from anybody, or to diminish this into just a materialistic view of what the thing is, destroys what's important to a person.
I agree. And I think that that's what makes me skeptical of the idea of this, of what's happening as a sort of umbrella globalist, you know, plot, whatever you want to call it. But I also, because there's so many moving parts. But what I also think about the imposition of the terms of this situation that we're in, it's basically, is it? I've been arguing this with my friend. Is this telling Irish people, hey, your history doesn't matter to this point. From here on in, this is what you do now. Forget all of these things. And do you do that in Spain, in Italy? Do you go, hey, forget Franco, forget your Spanish Civil War, forget, like, it basically the idea that the set of this 1% can go to the whole of the European Union and go, hey, Estonia, doesn't matter about your history. Hey, Greece, yeah, we get it, but forget about it. From now on in, stay inside, remote living.
Yeah. No more Zybon, whatever.
OnlyFans. Get your OnlyFans going, or fan, whatever it is. Whatever. Yeah. But so my point is, like, surely it's the greatest overreach in our culture, because it's saying to everyone fundamentally, and I think the realization is slowly moving to people. If it's in its most malign state, that, like, if this is how we live like this, then none of the things that mattered to us before matter now. If no one can stand on a stage, there's no art that isn't validated by the state. There's no comedy. There's no theater. There's nothing of the things that you like. They don't happen. You don't dance with a stranger. As I said to my friend, and she had an almost fit, you know, when I said, hey, you know, under lockdown, you don't dance with a stranger. She's just like, she never really thought about it. That you're trying to celebrate the argument, but it just seems like the greatest overreach. I don't know. What the fuck are we talking
about? What are we talking about? I don't know. I don't know.
And let's leave it there. Who the fuck knows what we're talking about? Who knows? None of us do. We're just floating in the ether. A combination of atoms trying to sense make. Anyway, there you go. Episode 2, part 2 of the chat with Josh Barnett. Until next time, my friends, Planet Satan over and out. Metal never bends.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.